This station is now the ultimate power in the universe. I suggest we use it.
The button pushing stops here.
Plug the radio in.
Yeah, because I can't get.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, it is time once again for Evidence for Faith, the Christian Evidences and Worldview radio program, where we help you understand the evidence that proves that Christianity is true and the kind of worldview that it provides, making the world a better place to live in. Hello, I'm Keith Kendricks.
Hi, I'm Dr. Mike Larakis, and I'd like to remind our listening audience that you can call us. You can call us at 398-1020. If you have any questions, you can also email us at evidenceforfaith.com. That's the number four, evidence, the number four, faith.com. We're also on Facebook and iTunes. So if you've missed any of our recent shows, you can actually download some of the audio files from either our website, Evidence for Faith, or from iTunes. And I think we're up to about, what, 90 now, Keith?
Yep, about 90 shows. 90 shows.
And speaking of shows, we have an awesome show today.
Yeah, we have a great guest that we are getting online now. He is one of the co-founders of the Intelligent Design Movement, Dr. Stephen C. Myers. So, and, yeah, that... Dr. Meyer is author of the book Signature in the Cell, and but we will get to that in a minute. Mike is back with us, so Mike, tell us about your vacation. That was great.
Well, I have to tell you, Keith, that I actually did not miss you these last two Sundays. Isn't that a terrible thing to say?
I'm telling you.
Well, I happened to be in Spain the night that the night that Spain won the World Cup, and I was actually in Madrid with friends and family, and what an awesome display of pride, nationalistic pride. The Spanish people haven't waved their flags since Franco was in power.
Wow.
He was the fascist dictator that was in power from the late 30s up until the 70s, and of course there's now a new Republican movement there with free elections and so forth, but there was no nationalistic pride until these past 2 weeks. There were flags flying everywhere.
Great.
So this was a really, really big time in Spain. And, of course, there are a lot of factions in Spain that want to divide the country. And our host family was telling us that this was a huge thing to try to bring the country together. And, of course, with today's news that the Spanish rider won the Tour de France.
Oh, it's even better.
Oh, it's even better. I mean, Spain is riding this crest of nationalism that's never been seen before. Of course, this was their first World Cup, and so they're a very, very happy bunch.
Well, you had a great vacation then.
Indeed.
Nancy and I had a wonderful weekend because our son, Stephen Kendricks, was commissioned as a second lieutenant in the Army.
So, well, that's awesome.
Yeah, so we're very proud of him. Shout out to Stephen and his dedication to... the United States and the freedoms that it represents and provides for people.
Oh, yeah, Stephen.
Yeah. Well, let's get into our topic today. No more news items, no more vacation talk. We have on the phone with us the author of Signature in the Cell, Dr. Stephen Meyer. Dr. Meyer, are you there?
Good afternoon.
How are you?
Very well.
Well, we're really proud to have you on the show. For our listening audience, Dr. Meyer is one of the co-founders of the Intelligent Design Movement and is an officer in something called the Discovery Institute. And I thought, Dr. Meyer, that we would start out by getting some of your background and telling us a little bit about yourself and a little bit about the Discovery Institute.
Sure. I started out in the sciences. I did an undergraduate double major in physics and geology, and went and worked in the oil industry for 4 or 5 years. And in 1985, when I was a young scientist working in I was doing geophysics. My bosses told me my job was to look for all out in the Gulf, and that was in Texas. So now they've got lots of all out in the Gulf, but in any case, a conference came to town, and it was a conference internationally known scientists and philosophers who were discussing the big issues and where they intersect, where science and philosophy intersected, the origin of the universe, the origin of life, and the origin and nature of human consciousness. And I attended the conference somewhat out of the blue. I had a friend tell me about it, and I came in off the street and listened, and I was just blown away by what I heard. And in particular, I got very interested in the question of the origin of the first life. There was a panel that day, leading scientists, all of whom admitted that we didn't really have any kind of evolutionary account for how the first life had arisen from the so-called prebiotic soup, how we got from simple chemicals to the simplest living cell. And I became fascinated in the topic. There was a scientist on the panel who happened to live in Dallas where I was working. I got to know him better and learn more about the mystery of life's origin, which was the title of his of a recent book he'd written. And a year later, I was off to graduate school in England. I was fortunate enough to get a Rotary Fellowship and went to study in Cambridge and began to do work in a field called the history and philosophy of science, and eventually wrote a PhD dissertation on this, the controversy over the origin of the first life. And that set me on a kind of a long quest to get to the bottom of the mystery. And the book Signature in the Cell is my attempt to pull it all together, which I finally finished last year.
Well, it's an excellent book. It's I'm sure people have seen it in the bookstores. It is thick. It's 600 pages, but it's an easy read. I finished it a couple months ago, and I was very intrigued. It kept me going because it has this very interesting history of the ideas revolving around the origin of life and the theories that were being developed and the discovery of DNA. And so it makes for a very fascinating read.
And one of the things that I might throw out there is that this book was one of the top 10 bestsellers on Amazon.com. So this is not a piece that you're going to put on the shelf and let it collect dust. It's a good book. Dr. Meyer, I have a question for you. I know that when you did your dissertation at Cambridge in 1991, you wrote it on Of Clues and Causes, a Methodological Interpretation of the Origin of Life Studies. Was that actually the foundational piece that you actually expanded into your book?
Well, it was, because I when I left Dallas to go to England for my postgraduate studies, I had kind of a burning question in the back of my mind. I had met a scientist, this scientist I mentioned, his name was Charles Thaxton, and in the epilogue to his book published in 1984, he had floated the idea that the resolution of the great mystery that was facing scientists about the origin of life might have something to do with intelligence, or with what he called an intelligent cause. And we later came to call that intelligent design. And his idea was kind of intuitive. The fundamental mystery surrounding the origin of life, the one that in the book I called the DNA enigma, is the question of the origin of the information that DNA stores. Turns out that DNA isn't just the beautiful double helix molecule that we know. It actually stores information in the form of a four-character digital code. It was one of Francis Crick's great insights in the late 1950s. He realized that along the spine of the DNA molecule, there are four chemicals that function just like alphabetic characters in a written language or digital characters like zeros and ones in a machine code. Only in the DNA, it's a four-character code. So, and the chemicals that function like letters or characters are represented by chemists with the letters A, T, G, and C. And what Dr. Thaxton recognized was that the big mystery for scientists trying to explain the origin of life was, where does that information come from? And he suggested, well, perhaps we could make more sense of it if we were willing to consider the idea of an intelligent cause, because we kind of intuitively recognize that information is a mind product. So it's something that comes from intelligence, not undirected processes. And so I set out to England with kind of a burning question in my mind, which was, could this intuition that Thaxton had expressed be developed into a rigorous scientific argument for intelligent design? I was intrigued but not convinced of his ideas at this point, and so I began to study the methods by which scientists investigate the remote past. And that led me to Charles Darwin and to his mentor, Charles Lyell, the great geologist, And I discovered that the scientists who were studying the remote past had some very common sense methods of reasoning that they employed to try to figure out what caused events to happen in the past. And when I was reading Darwin and Lyell, I came across their key principle of reasoning, which was that when we're trying to determine the cause of events in the remote past, we should be looking for a cause which is known to produce the effects in question. What Lyell had a phrase, he said, we should be looking for causes now in operation, what we know from our experience of cause and effect. And when I saw that phrase and understood the principle behind it, the light went on for me, because I began to ask myself a question: what is the cause, the known cause, the cause now in operation for the production of information, for the production of digital code? And I realized there was only one, and it's intelligence. And so I realized that by applying Darwin's scientific method of reasoning about the past, the modern evidence pointed to a decidedly non-Darwinian conclusion, that the evidence of information inside cells pointed to an intelligent cause, and therefore it was possible to make a rigorous scientific case for intelligent design, which is precisely what I attempted to do in Signature in the Cell.
And followed basically the plan that Darwin did in Origin of Species.
I used the same scientific method of reasoning, yeah. But of course I came to a different conclusion. Darwin denied there was evidence of design, but he didn't know what we now know. He didn't know about the nanotechnology inside cells, the miniature machines, and the rotary engines and sliding clamps and all of that. And he also didn't know about the digital code in the DNA molecule or the complex information processing system that the cell uses to read and express and organize that information. So we're looking at high-tech digital nanotechnology inside every living cell of every living organism. And, you know, it's hard to say what Darwin would have concluded if he had known what we know, but what I can say is that if you apply his method of reasoning rigorously to what we now know that he didn't know, the most logical thing to conclude is that there was a designing intelligence responsible for life.
Well, tell us a little bit more about some of that nanotechnology, because I find that this is one of the areas that the general population still has not gotten the word out and don't seem to understand that there have been these amazing discoveries of these what really you have to describe as machines. And in one case, you might even describe this item as a robot, the way that it walks one foot in front of the other. And this is actually going on inside living cells.
Yeah, absolutely. If some of your listeners have seen the film Expelled, there's a wonderful animation sequence there where the filmmakers have their animator actually show what's going on inside cells. And there's one of the sequences is with one of these incredible motor proteins that actually walk like a robot along a track. They pull vesicles with crucial supplies for the cell, and there's a transportation system inside the cell that's motorized. It's just absolutely incredible. My story has to do with not so much the molecular machines, although I discussed that in some ways, but it's about the way the information, the four-character code in DNA, directs the construction of all the proteins and protein machines that the cell needs to stay alive. Sometimes a picture is worth a thousand words, and if your listeners don't have the movie Expelled handy, they could go to my website where there's a piece of animation that we've had rendered that shows exactly how the digital code in the DNA molecule directs the construction of the protein machinery.
Yeah.
And the closest analogy that I've been able to think of, and it's one I used in the book, was that may also give people a handle on what's going on, is to a technology that we use in manufacturing plants, whether it's the Ford Motor Company or Boeing Aircraft or many other companies, use a technology called CAD-CAM, Computer Assisted Design and Manufacture. It's a technology whereby we use digital information to direct the construction of mechanical parts. For example, at the Boeing plant, an engineer will sit at a console, a computer console, make some selections of parameters for the building of a particular part. Those selections are literally codified. They're expressed and stored in digital code. The code is sent down a wire. It's then translated into another machine code that can be read by a manufacturing center. That signal carrying that code is then sent to the manufacturing center, and it then directs the construction of a mechanical part. For example, the code may tell the rivet arm exactly, or the robotic arm exactly where to put the rivets on on an airplane wing. And that is precisely what's going on inside the cell. We're not building airplane wings, but the cell is building mechanical parts made of protein that do all the critical functions in the cell. And we've, as I mentioned on the website for my book, we've animated that. There's about a three-minute piece of animation that will really, I think, open up the world. We call it Journey Inside the Cell, and it really opens up what the information technology is doing to construct some of the key protein parts of the cell.
And I saw that video today, and it is excellent. It goes along with some other video clips that are out there, but this is at signatureinthecell.com.
Yeah, that's right.
So I recommend people go there. It is excellent. And I know from firsthand experience of trying to explain to people about intelligent design, and in one case, my father never really seemed to get it until I took him to the computer and I showed him some of this animation, and he talked about it for weeks afterwards and told all his friends. And prior to that, whenever I mentioned intelligent design, his first reaction was, well, that's junk science.
That's been the media's line on it, and it is. It's been quite an education for us to see how much the mainstream media can influence public opinion without really ever allowing people to see what an issue is really about. But intelligent design was in the news quite a lot. In 2005, there was a school board that was trying to get a book discussing intelligent design put in its library. The ACLU sued. The school board handled the case really poorly, and they ended up losing it. And it created a national media firestorm around the issue, and there was all kinds of publicity. Initially, I think most of that hurt us because the media covered this as the replay of the Scopes trial, and it was intelligent design was portrayed as religion masquerading as science, or we were called creationists in cheap tuxedos and so forth. But this is a science-based idea. It's based on scientific evidence. It's an inference from biological evidence, and one which, as I mentioned before, is based on the same methods of scientific reasoning that have been used since the time of Darwin, when methods for investigating the remote past were first developed in science. So it's a scientific research program, and when people see the evidence, it does really change their view of what we're talking about.
You are listening to Evidence for Faith. Hi, I'm Dr. Mike Larrakis.
And I'm Keith Kendricks.
And today with us we have Stephen Meyer, the author of Signature in the Cell, and his book outlines the DNA evidence for intelligent design. And Dr. Meyer, I have a question for you with respect to the intelligent design movement. We know that you and Philip Johnson are co-founders of the ID movement, and of course Philip Johnson's a lawyer and a spectacular apologist who has taken our cause over the last 20 years very beautifully, really actually starting back in the late 80s with his book Darwin on Trial. And I know that Stephen Jay Gould crucified him, and that was one of the impetuses, if you will, to start the intelligent design movement. I actually admire what the two of you have been doing, and it's almost like a modern-day David and Goliath thing where you guys are taking on the establishment, the scientific establishment, and throwing stones at their intelligence. What would you say to any scientist, let's say you have a three-minute closing argument in a debate or a lecture, who is a skeptic? What would you say in the last 3 minutes of your closing argument with respect to intelligent design and why they have to consider it as a real issue in this day of lost science?
Well, sure, there are many arguments for intelligent design and many classes of evidence that support the conclusion that a designing intelligence played a role either in the origin of the universe, for example, the fine-tuning of the laws of physics and chemistry point to that, or in the origin of various aspects of life or living systems. I should also mention that the research community around the theory of intelligent design has grown remarkably in 20 years since the publication of Darwin on Trial. I would also say that there were a number of other key founders to this scientific perspective. Charles Faxon, the scientist that influenced me, would be one, and his co-author Walter Bradley played a big role. So there's been a lot of key people in this. It's not a one-man show. But the argument for design that I find most compelling is the one that I developed in Signature in the Cell. And let me sketch it for you. Since you said 3 minutes, I'll try to do it in a minute and a half since I've already talked for a little bit. As I mentioned, Francis Crick had this key insight. He called it the sequence hypothesis, the idea that along the spine of the DNA molecule is code, is a four-character digital code, chemicals functioning just like alphabetic characters in a written language. Bill Gates says the DNA is like a software program, only much more complex than any we've ever created. That's a hugely suggestive insight, because we know from experience, from uniform and repeated experience, the basis of all scientific reasoning, that code comes from programmers. Programs come from programmers. In fact, we know more generally that information, in whatever form we find it, whether it's a hieroglyphic inscription, a section of computer code, a paragraph in a book, even information embedded in a radio signal, whenever we find information and we trace it back to its source, we always come to an intelligence, to a mind, not a material process. So the discovery of information embedded along the spine of the DNA molecule, directing the construction of all that protein machinery, is a compelling indicator of prior intelligence. And in making that conclusion, again, we're basing our reasoning on our knowledge of cause and effect, our uniform and repeated experience of cause and effect, which is the basis of all scientific reasoning about the past and the principle by which Darwin himself reasoned. So this is not only a scientifically based argument in that it's based on scientific evidence, it's also using an established scientific method, and therefore should be considered a scientific conclusion.
Now, Dr. Meyer, this information that you're talking about that's in the DNA, and it's in the form of a code, but I think in your book you also bring out the fact that this code then has to be translated into another step, into another different code, in order to build these parts that would then go into the construction of some of these nano machines. So can you describe that a little bit? It seems to me
exactly.
That this is...
Well, this is also what's portrayed in the animation that we described a minute ago. I've been told, in the book, I try to weave a case, a scientific case based on evidence, with what is basically a mystery story. Mm. The mystery is, I call the DNA enigma. Where did all the information come from? And I've been told that the hardest chapter of the book is chapter 5, where I describe the molecular biology in some detail, and precisely this what's called the translation or the transcription and translation system, or also known as the gene expression system, how the information in DNA directs the construction of proteins. But there's basically two main processes that are involved, one in which the information in the original DNA double helix is copied by a large protein complex called a polymerase, which produces an RNA, single-stranded RNA copy of the original message that was stored in the DNA double helix. And that has a slightly different basis in coding, in that one of the chemical letters in the DNA alphabet is not present in the RNA alphabet and vice versa. But the information is transmitted into this slightly different system of conveyance. And then that single-stranded RNA molecule is copied during a process known as translation, and that's where the proteins are produced. It's interesting that when we use the CAD-CAM technology in an airplane manufacturing plant or automobile manufacturing plant, there's also an initial language, an initial coding system that's then translated into a machine code that the machine, that the mechanical assembly machinery can read. So the similarity between the technologies is really rather remarkable, and I think if anything just adds to the eerie sense of design that we're looking at.
Right. Now, one of the interesting things about your book is that this is not just a negative attack on evolution. So many times Christians that you talk to that believe in evolution, if you ask them why do they believe in evolution, why don't they believe in intelligent design, they'll say, well, it's only negative. You know, you're just bashing, just saying that life is so complicated that we don't know how evolution could have done it. And for them, that's not enough to have a negative attack. But this, your book is actually giving positive evidence, not that evolution couldn't have done it, but that intelligence actually did do it.
Right. I use, again, the method of reasoning that was used by Darwin. It's used widely in science. It has a name. It's called inference to the best explanation, or sometimes called the method of multiple competing hypotheses. And what the scientists are doing when they're using this method is they're trying to infer that explanation, which, if true, would provide that hypothesis, which, if true, would provide the best explanation of the evidence, where best, especially in this historical context, is the hypothesis that provides a cause which is uniquely known to produce the kind of evidence you're trying to explain. So it's not an argument from ignorance. Oftentimes what we said, you know, it's expressed exactly as you put it. The critique of our work is expressed exactly as you put it. All you're saying is that life is so complex that it couldn't have evolved. And then you invoke some mysterious concept called intelligent design to stand as a placeholder for our ignorance. Well, that's not it at all. There is a critique of the various they're called chemical evolutionary theories when you're trying to explain the origin of the first life from simple chemicals. And I show that various types of evolutionary theories have all failed to account for the origin of life because they've come up to an impasse when they try to explain the origin of information. That is to say, there isn't a known materialistic entity or cause which is capable of producing information. We know of no material cause, that can produce large amounts of functionally specified information, especially in a digital form. But there is a cause of which we know that is capable of producing information. And we know about this from our uniform and repeated experience. And again, it's mind or intelligence. There's a leading information theorist in the 1960s who was a pioneer in applying information theory to molecular biology, and he made a comment that I think it really caught my attention when I came across it, because he said that the creation of new information is habitually associated with conscious activity. And I thought about that, and I thought, that's right, that's something we know from experience. And I knew from my studies of origin of life research and my ordinary experience as a sort of sentient being that there is no other known cause of specified information other than intelligence. And so this conclusion, the conclusion that intelligent design provides the best explanation, is a positive conclusion based on our knowledge of cause and effect. The way I develop the argument in Signature in the Cell is I show that it's an inference. Intelligent design is an inference to the best explanation because it invokes the only cause known to produce the effect in question.
One of the things that I find fascinating about all of this, Dr. Meyer, is the fact that you're using, the body of intelligent design scientists are using scientific fact to come to a different conclusion, which I believe makes a whole lot more sense than the evolutionary conclusion that's been brought forth for the last 150 years.
Go ahead, finish your question, sorry.
Well, no, the concern that I have is that frequently the way they cut your knees out from under you is by saying that there's no body of evidence or a body of work in a peer-reviewed scientific journal that would support your movement. But you're using the actual scientific work of the scientific community and putting it together and showing people that there is, in fact, a better explanation.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, we keep a porthole on our website that just lists all the peer-reviewed scientific publications that have been published that support intelligent design. I think we just posted an abstract of a new article just last week written by a professor of thermodynamics at the University of Leeds in the United Kingdom. So the network of scientists who support intelligent design is growing very fast. It's international. It includes some very highly qualified scientists. We have a new journal called Biocomplexity that has a 32-person strong editorial board, all of established scientists, several of whom are members of national academies in their respective countries. It's an international board. So the scientific research community that is interested and supportive of intelligent design is growing, And as I mentioned, the argument is based on evidence, scientific evidence, and a standard method of scientific reasoning. One thing that might be worth noting, though, is that though the theory of intelligent design is based on science, that doesn't mean it might not have religious implications. Certainly many people who have been supportive of Darwinism over the years, Darwinian evolution, have been very outspoken about its anti-religious implications or its materialistic implications. Many scientists see Darwinism, if true, as having implications that support a materialistic or atheistic worldview, in that it affirms that the process by which new life arose was purely unguided and undirected and purely material in its basis. If the theory of intelligent design is true, it implies that there was a mind of some kind that was responsible for the production of life, and there's also design arguments based on developments in cosmology and physics that suggest that the universe itself had a basis in intelligence or mind. And so I think if you begin to reflect on that, the theory of intelligent design itself goes so far as to say there was some kind of intelligence, but if you begin to reflect on that in a philosophical way, you realize that there's only so many candidates for an intelligence that would be capable of performing those tasks. Some have said, well, maybe it's an intelligence that's imminent within the cosmos, and some very prominent scientists have actually proposed that maybe there were space aliens or something that intelligently created and then seeded life on Earth. The problem with that is twofold. One, if we can't explain life in the first place on Earth, it doesn't get much easier to explain by bumping the problem out into outer space. So you've just pushed the problem back one generation. But secondly, not only is there evidence of design at the very beginning of life, but there's also evidence of design in the very fabric of the universe itself, and what physicists refer to as the fine-tuning, the anthropic fine-tuning, the fine-tuning of the laws of and constants of physics, the fine-tuning of the initial conditions of the universe. And that seems to point to a design which transcends the universe itself, that points beyond it. And for that reason, I think the scientific evidence is actually the implications of the theory of intelligent design and the evidence that we see, I think, it points in a theistic direction. It seems to point to an intelligence which is not immanent and within the cosmos, but transcendent. And for that and many other reasons, I happen to be a theist and indeed a Christian. I don't think you can prove Christianity from the scientific evidence, but I think it does provide support for certainly the narrow scientific theory of intelligent design, but I think as you begin to reflect on it more broadly, I think that theory has implications that are what Philip Johnson used to say, the implications are theistic friendly. And I don't think there's anything illegitimate in that. Many theories have larger implications. We don't judge theories by whether we like or dislike the implications. The theory of intelligent design is based on science, but it has larger implications that I think are friendly to traditional religious belief.
Well, if you're just joining us, you are listening to Evidence for Faith. I'm Keith Kendricks.
And hi, I'm Dr. Mike Larakis. And today we have with us Dr. Stephen Meyer, author of Signature in the Cell. And we're having a wonderful discussion with Dr. Meyer. Question, Dr. Meyer, and this is sort of a follow-up to what you were just discussing. One of the problems that we have as we're engaging the scientific community, and the truth is becoming more and more evident to them, they blow us off and call us religious creationists. What do you say to them when they hammer you with that tag?
Well, I always feign hurt feelings, you know, especially when they call us creationists in cheap tuxedos. But really, when you have training in law or philosophy or logic, when you find that your opponent is resorting to name-calling or ad hominem abuse, that's typically a sure sign of running out of good arguments. I mean, those are logical fallacies. It doesn't. So dismissive insults really don't stand as good arguments. Now, unfortunately, a lot of people who have argued for design or a religious point of view have often been weak on evidence and argument, and so it's. So I think the key thing is to keep the focus on the evidence and to formulate arguments that have some rigor to them that are put together well and logical. And I think when you do that, people's minds are changed and their minds are opened. But I also think right now that the fact that there are so many in the Darwinist community, the evolutionary establishment, that are resorting to that kind of ad hominem and name calling, labeling, I think that's a sign of the bankruptcy of the overall Darwinian system. And I say that having assessed the key evidential claims of the theory, and realizing that I think it's got big, big problems. And I think to me, the key is not the labels and the media stereotypes, but keep the focus on the arguments and the evidence, and I think people are gradually won over.
Dr. Meyer, getting back to the actual mechanics of what's going on in the DNA, if I recall from your book, you talk about the fact that the DNA is really doesn't have all the information that it takes to build an organism, that the DNA is more or less the list of the parts that you need to make. Like if you're building a house, it might list doors and bricks and shingles, and then it would tell you how to build a door and where doors go and that kind of thing. But as to the actual layout of how many rooms, or in the case if you take an organism, is this organism going to have four legs or two legs, and that kind of information, does it, if I get it right, it's not actually in the DNA, it's somewhere else.
Well, that's right, and I really like the way you developed the analogy with the parts list and in the house. I think you did it better than I did in the book. But this is principally a problem not so much for evolutionary theories of the first life, although it may be a problem at that level too, but it's definitely a problem for Darwinian evolution. There are two branches of evolutionary theory. Chemical evolutionary theory attempts to explain the origin of the first life from simpler non-living chemicals. And the main thesis of my book was a critique of chemical evolutionary theory and of the proposal of intelligent design as an alternative to chemical evolutionary theory to explain the origin of the first life. But in the epilogue of the book, I look at some of the other research questions that flow from our perception and understanding of design. And one of them has to do with what we call ontogenetic information, information that is stored at levels beyond the genome, beyond the DNA. And we now know that DNA it codes for proteins, but proteins have to be organized into cellular structures. And cell types, distinctive cellular structures characterize distinctive cell types, which have to be organized into tissues, and tissues have to be organized into organs, and organs and tissues into body plans. That is, if you're to build a new organism, you have to have these higher orders of organization. And DNA does not control all that higher level organization. It certainly builds the proteins. It may influence the way proteins are organized, but there's an awful lot of organization that is not directed by DNA. And therefore, there must be other sources of information in the cell and in the organism that are responsible for what's called body plan morphogenesis, building a new form of an organism. And as we've learned more and more and begin to realize more and more about the presence and need for these higher levels of information, that has raised additional problems for the other branch of evolutionary theory, for neo-Darwinian biological evolutionary theory, because according to neo-Darwinism, new form arises as natural selection acts on changes in DNA, the mutations in the genome. That is to say, changes in information stored at the lowest level of the biological hierarchy. But if DNA alone is not sufficient to organize proteins into cell types, tissues, organs, and body plans, then you can mutate DNA indefinitely. It's no longer a matter of time and chances and number of trials. It's just the wrong tool for the job. You don't have DNA will, in the best of cases, if mutated long enough, it might be able to build you a new protein, but it's not going to explain how the proteins get organized into the cell types and the cell types into the tissues and the tissues and the organs into new body plans. And so what we can, I think, pretty firmly conclude is that the neo-Darwinian mechanism, which was what Darwin thought replaced the need to invoke design, can be very decisively shown to be insufficient to produce fundamentally new forms of life. And so the question that Darwin set out to solve back in 1859, which is the question of the origin of new form, is still very much with us. It's unsolved from the standpoint of mainstream evolutionary theory.
Now, this problem then, it seems that would explain what we read about some of the experiments, for instance, that they've done with fruit flies, where they've irradiated the DNA of the fruit fly. And I read one account that said that basically they had irradiated every single point on and modified every single point on a fruit fly's DNA, and yet it still remains a fruit fly of some type. It might be mutated to have four wings instead of two, but you really get nothing. There is no different body
plan. You don't
get
any fundamentally new form, exactly. I have a colleague, Jonathan Wells, summarizing the results of those experiments. He said, you know, we've performed every mutation that we could think of on these poor creatures since the beginning of the last century, and we get three types of fruit flies. We get normal fruit flies, mutant or deformed fruit flies, and dead fruit flies, but we don't get anything fundamentally new. And there are actually multiple problems with the theories about how mutations supposedly generate new form. But this problem of what's called ontogenetic information is one of the most fundamental ones, because it really takes the whole debate out of the realm of speculations about chance or time or probabilities. It's simply mutating DNA alone is not going to build you a new animal. It's very clear as we learn more about what is involved in the construction of a body plan.
Now, and I believe you indicate that it seems like that information may be in the cell itself outside the nucleus, so that in the case of sperm and egg getting together, the sperm provides part of the DNA information. The other part is in the egg, but then the egg, the outside of the nucleus of the egg, will actually contain the information that will provide where are these proteins going to go, where are you going to start adding on new limbs and
yeah, there's,
the
there's
body
clearly
plan.
Structural information in the architecture of the maternal embryo. Mm. There's also information in the architecture of the cell itself. There's a protein called tubulin that's a little building block that makes the cytoskeleton inside the cells. And there are lots of different cytoskeletons, different structures in different types of cells, but they're all made of the same protein building block, tubulin. So the DNA codes for building the tubulin, but it's not clear. It appears that the three-dimensional structure of the cytoskeleton, which is all made of these tubulin subunits, is inherited from one cell structure to the next. It's heritable structural information. So that's a source of information that's not coming from DNA alone. DNA makes the building blocks, but doesn't determine how the building blocks are arranged. That's only, that's just two of the many possible sources of extra genomic information about which we know. There's an awful lot of other information that must be there that science really hasn't fully elucidated. We don't know exactly where it all is, but it's an active area of research. But that's another key point, I think, that if you're wedded to the neo-Darwinian perspective, you're disinclined to look for any crucial information beyond the genome, because you're committed to the idea that all the information you need is either in the original genome or in the mutations that occur in the genome. And for that reason, Darwinism has actually, I think, impeded scientific research into an area that is beginning to net some real insights, and that is sometimes called the area of research is called epigenesis or ontogenetic information. And whereas, conversely, the theory of intelligent design, because it's not wedded to the idea that mutations produced everything, is open to other sources of information. And in fact, I would say that the idea of a hierarchically organized informational system is something that actually points to intelligent design in another way. We know of only one cause of information, but we also know of only one cause of systems that are hierarchically organized, where you have multiple layers of information being expressed. Mm. And again, those are systems that have been designed by human beings. Computers actually have that kind of hierarchical organization of information. So I think the more we learn about life, the the deeper our appreciation of the evidence that there is for design becomes. And so that's one of the reasons that intelligent design is not just a good scientific argument, it's also, I think, going to be scientifically fruitful in that it's opening our eyes to realities that you wouldn't necessarily look at if you were strictly wedded to a Darwinian viewpoint.
You are listening to Evidence for Faith, and with us, special guest, Dr. Stephen C. Meyer. Hi, I'm Dr. Mike Larakis.
And I'm Keith Kendricks.
And Dr. Meyer, I have a question for you. I'm a physician internist, and frequently my patients will find out that I am a Christian, and they are confused a little bit by the fact that I believe in creationism versus evolution. And their question of me is, how can you, as a scientist and a physician, take that stance? And I try to tell them that very early on in my medical school training, I learned that genetic mutations cause nothing but disease, death, and deformity. Those are the three Ds, and that's what I tell people. And I've always found that the mutation part of the theory of evolution was, I felt, the weak or the Achilles heel in their argument. I've also tried to express to my patients why it is that I believe what I believe because of all of the arguments that we're espousing, and I've always maintained that DNA is the thumbprint of God, or the language of God, or however you want to express it. But
or,
we're all
or
the
signature in the cell.
Exactly. That's exactly correct.
Yeah, or Francis Collins' title, The Language of God.
The Language of God, exactly. And that's the adenine, thymine, cytosine, and guanine, the ATGC code that we're talking about in DNA. So I think that you hit on a very, very special point when you talked about mutations and the Drosophila and the fruit flies and so forth being what they are. You're either dead or deformed or mutant or whatever. And I think that it's just an amazing journey that we as scientists are taking in the last, really, since 1954 when DNA was discovered by Watson and Crick. But again, we, in all fairness to Mr. Darwin, 150 years ago, he had no idea what DNA was all about.
Yeah.
And my question...
Really, it really ought to have been a kind of a stop press moment for the whole, you know, the scientific community. When Watson and Crick realized, I mean, they elucidated the structure of the molecule in 1953. But in 1957, Crick had this brilliant insight. He was a code breaker in World War II and a physicist by training. And he realized that there was a coding system inside the cell and that the sequence hypothesis was the idea that the four chemicals, the bases, are functioning just like alphabetic characters in written language or digital characters in machine code. And that's a stunning discovery, stunning insight, that information, every cell is running in accord with digital code that's directing its manufacturing, the manufacturing of all the proteins. So information is running the show in life. Now, as it's taken the biological community a while to process that, and in the 60s in particular, this seemed to many scientists to provide more support for the idea that mutations were the key driving force in biological change, in evolution. But the problem with that, and this has begun to dawn on a lot of scientists, is that when you begin to realize that DNA contains information, something like code or a paragraph in a book, and that a mutation is an undirected change to that informational sequence, you have to ask yourself a question. If I begin to randomly, in an undirected fashion, change the order and arrangement of letters in a Shakespearean sonnet or a piece of Bill Gates' software, am I more likely to degrade the meaning and the functional information that was there before, or am I more likely to be adding to it? Well, it turns out that as people have studied this very carefully and mathematically, and I describe the work of one scientist in particular who's done an extensive bit of experimental work on just this question, the odds are overwhelmingly in favor of the idea that you will be degrading meaning, not adding to it. And in fact, what it turns out that as you randomly change the genetic information for one protein, you can get away with two or three changes at different positions, minor point mutations. But as you begin to make multiple changes at multiple sites, invariably you degrade the existing protein function before you ever come across new protein function. And what that means is you end up terminating evolution at the point that you destroy function, because natural selection selects for functional advantage. So you're falling off into a cliff of non-functional abyss before you ever rise out of it and come to something new. And so what we now know about the rarity of functional proteins in among all the different combinations there are of the amino acids out of which proteins are made, the rarity of functional genes out of all the different ways you can arrange the A, C's, G's, and T's, it now looks as though there are strict limits on how much a change mutation can produce. And so that's another critical consideration in suggesting that mutation theory just doesn't account for the origin of the new form, even at the protein level that we need to build new organisms.
Mm. Well, Dr. Meyer, we only have a few more minutes left in the end of the show here, but I'd like to hear more about some of the other projects that you're working on. I know I saw you in a video that I recommend to everyone called Unlocking the Mystery of Life. And are you doing any other things like that?
Well, we have a new video that's just come out that's about not so much the origin of the first life, but the origin of new body plans, the origin of fundamentally new organisms, many of which first arise in an event in the history of life called the Cambrian Explosion. And the video is called Darwin's Dilemma, The Mystery of the Cambrian Explosion. It's available on Amazon along with many of our books and other materials. There's a whole series of documentaries that we've done in conjunction with a film company called Illustra Media, one called The Mystery of Life's Origin, another called Privileged Planet. If your listeners go on our website, they'll find a listing of the many books that our scientists and scholars have produced. I think we're closing in on 100 books in the 12 years since we started our program. So there are books about the scientific basis of intelligent design, and also about the social and worldview consequences of the debate over origins. And so there's just a wealth of material for people that are interested in these, in how science intersects with these foundational worldview questions, how science intersects with faith, and so I guess I'd recommend our website as a good clearinghouse for that. That's discovery.org.
All right, and tell us about your true you.
Oh right, that's an apologetics series that I did separately from Discovery. Discovery is an organization that has scientists and philosophers and people who work on policy, and it's not a faith-based organization. We think the theory of intelligent design has positive implications for faith, but I happen to be a Christian, and I've done on a separate track with Focus on the Family and Tyndale Publishers a teaching series that based on a class that I used to teach when I was a college professor. And the series is called True You, short for University. And the first 10 parts of the series are a scientific case for intelligent design, and then going further than that, looking at the implications of design for theistic belief. I argue that there's a strong basis for belief in God based on science and based on our experience based on our moral experience, and I develop a moral argument for God's existence as well as a scientific argument. And then there's a second part that's coming out in the fall that is a 10-lecture series on the historical reliability of the Bible. And I think people can find out about that at trueu.org, where the U is capitalized.
Dr. Meyer, one last question for you. I know that you're friendly with Ben Stein, who was expelled from the New York Times. I was wondering if you had spoken with him since his expulsion and whether or not his involvement in the movie Expelled had anything to do with his exiting the New York Times.
Yeah, he was pretty convinced that it did. I have spoken with Mr. Stein. He's a delightful character. He's one of the few celebrities that you meet who's exactly the same off camera as they are on camera. He's just a real kick to be around. He was in Seattle about a year ago, and I had a chance to reconnect, and he told us some of the backstory and the grounds by which he was expelled from his, and his column was terminated at the New York Times, and he wrote a column on economics and business, and they claimed that it was a conflict of interest for him to endorse products, but many columnists and people do that. It didn't seem to really to have anything to do with that, and he was pretty convinced that they were not happy about some of the politically incorrect stands he'd taken, in particular his support for intelligent design. He was also disinvited from a speaking engagement at the University of Vermont. He had been asked to be a graduation speaker and was disinvited after protests about his involvement and expelled. So he's been expelled for his involvement and expelled a couple of times. And, of course, he's come up on his feet. Ben's got lots of talent, creative energies, and he's involved in lots of things. So I think it was the New York Times' loss and certainly the University of Vermont's loss not to get Ben Stein, not the other way around.
Well, Dr. Meyer, it has been a real pleasure having you on. We really appreciate you coming on to Evidence for Faith. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on. I really appreciated the conversation and the good questions.
Great. Well, you've been listening to Evidence for Faith with Keith Kendricks.
And Mike Larakis.
And join us again next Sunday at 4 p.m. We're going to be asking the question about the strange religion of Christianity. How does it compare to other religions? So join us each Sunday at 4 p.m. for more reasons to believe. And always remember that the best reason for being a Christian is because it's true.